This is KUOW's The Record. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. If you're a Western Washington liberal, you know why rural Washington voted for Donald Trump. The stories are in your Facebook feed. They're in your trusted newspapers. Rural America is racist, xenophobic, and misogynistic, or else they're mad because the global economy took their jobs. That's the story, anyway. Crosscut reporter David Croman decided to go and meet some of these voters. He drove across the mountains to Ritzville in Washington's Adams County.
One narrative I think we keep hearing is, we talk so much about the recovery of the recession, but all these white working class people aren't experiencing that necessarily. And so that's what I expected to hear. And it seemed like going to one of the poorer counties in Washington would be a good place to hear that.
And what did you actually hear?
You know, I mean, obviously there's some of that because everybody hurt in the recession, but it wasn't at the forefront as much as I expected it to be. One of my first interviews was with the clerk treasurer of Ritzville, and she talked about how, you know, the economy of Ritzville and parts of Adams County was propped up on agriculture, which has a lot of federal subsidies, and travelers going to and from Seattle or Spokane stopping in these towns, neither of which were necessarily recession prone. Not to say, again, that it was easy for them, but the major complaints that I heard were, honestly, as I was hearing them, things that were really intuitive and things that I've always sort of, I guess, known about Eastern Washington. We feel like we don't have a voice.
This is Olympia and Washington, D.C. they're complaining about?
Yeah, exactly. Especially, I would say the ire for Olympia is probably even stronger than their ire for Washington, D.C. Just this sort of image of all these elites sitting around a table making decisions on Eastern Washington's behalf. I think is a more powerful narrative than people in Seattle really can even understand. Every time I would tell someone I'm from Seattle, you'd get this little eye roll, and you know, people are basically nice, but would make note of that and say, you know, I won't hold that against you too much.
So is that do you think the root of their frustration? First of all, are they even frustrated? Is that fair to say?
Not everyone I talked to was frustrated. I had this good conversation with this woman who owned a coffee shop in Ritzville. Talked about how things were basically going really well for her and her husband. She was ecstatic about the fact that she could afford a house out there for $50,000. Said basically, in general, people are doing pretty well. It's a pretty common joke that I heard about the wives of farmers driving around in Cadillacs because they get so many subsidies from the federal government.
How do they reconcile that? Did people engage with that?
No, kidding? Not really. I mean, so I asked this one woman about it who, as she was finishing up this thought about how people in Western Washington or, you know, poor people who live in Seattle depend on the government and we out here work really hard for what we have. I followed that up pretty quickly with, well, what do you say about the millions and millions of dollars of federal subsidies that you get? And she sort of said, well, that's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that was basically her answer.
So it's less frustration than that eye rolling?
Well, I would say, I mean, the sense that I got is that there was a lot of it had to do with kind of a nostalgic feeling, kind of a vagueness. One of the men that I talked to who owned a shop in downtown Ritzville, also a city councilman in Ritzville, said, you know, I'm okay with changing culture, but it can't happen too fast. And so I think that sort of gets, if anything, gets to the base of what the people I spoke to were motivating their vote after. It's that America is changing in this way, and it's not necessarily economically, but it's becoming more multicultural. President Obama is inviting Syrian refugees in, and there's a real worry that culturally, more than economically, they don't necessarily have a place in that.
They have to be more politically correct.
Right.
How they refer to people. They feel out of their comfort zone.
That's the sense I was getting at the root of what I found is worry that this sort of idyllic image of rural America was somehow going to be taken away from them. But also, I mean, there's so much talk about the anxiety of the white working class and how that flipped this election. But to a certain extent, I feel like they get a lot of attention because they are a swing vote. So, you know, a lot of people voted for Obama in 2012, apparently now voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and that's kind of been the narrative. But the reality is places like Ritzville or places out here in eastern Washington, have been voting for Republicans forever. And that is the real foundation. The majority of people who voted for Donald Trump voted for him because they've always voted for Republicans. And they have just always, they've decided a long time ago that Republicans have the back of agriculture. They're less interested in regulation, which, and they like that. So we talk a lot about how this was some sort of revolutionary vote against change and populism and all that. But
a backlash, a white lash.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you go out to a place like Ritzville, and I'm not sure I would have heard anything different 4 years ago had I gone out there and talked to people about why they voted for Mitt Romney.
But how do they talk about the misogyny and the racism and the mocking the disabled and the groping?
Right. Well, one man I was talking to said he was with a group of women when the groping video came out, and he said none of the women he was around really, you know, cared about that. And the racism bit, they're very quick to distance themselves from the KKK or any of those groups. But at the same time, there's this sort of, I think for Seattleites, almost outdated interpretation of race, which is, how can I be racist? I don't even see color. One person told me, I treat everybody like they're white, as if that was the quality necessarily, that you should just treat everybody like you would treat a white person. So the conversation out there sounds a lot different than I think what Seattle people are used to.
David, what did you take away? What do you want us to take away from the picture you got from Ritzville?
I think we on the west side of the mountains underestimate how disenfranchised and how distant people feel from decision makers, especially in this state. And I think on the east side of the mountains, they underestimate how important multiculturalism is in places like Seattle. You know, people say these things about Muslims, that if you read in the piece or whatever that I write, then that's all you get. It sounds sort of terrifying for a Seattleite, but I think you can go out there and understand that it comes from a place of basically these people just don't know any Muslims. They would say these things about how, you know, I've heard that all Muslims support honor killings or Sharia law. And then I would immediately ask, how many Muslims do you know? And they would say none. They've never met a Muslim. So I just think these divisions can be broken down pretty easily just by simple people-to-people interactions.
Did your trip change you? Or is it about, yeah, it's about what I figured.
Well, I mean, so part of the reason I liked going out there and wanted to do this story is that I've lived in Eastern Washington and I've worked in Eastern Washington before. And so what's actually been surprising since I published the story is how much reaction I've gotten to it, which is quite a bit, because none of this was necessarily surprising to me. I mean, it was just basically good people out there who feel like government shouldn't play much of a role, and that kind of informs a lot of their decisions. And that has always been kind of an intuitive thing to me about Eastern Washington. But since I've published, I've gotten more reaction to this piece than anything I've written about Seattle, really. And that surprises me, that this story is at all surprising to anybody.
What's the gist of the reaction?
I mean, positive, but just that it is notable that I drove across the mountains and took 2 days to putz around Ritzville and talk to people. It didn't feel that notable to me, but people are sending me notes and saying, oh, I'm so happy you did this and stuff like that. I mean, it's basically positive stuff, but it seemed like such a simple thing to do, to go over there and just ask people why you voted for Donald Trump. And yet the fact that I'm getting more reaction to it than basically anything else I've written suggests to me that it's just not happening that often, that either of us are crossing the mountains and just asking each other, why did you vote this way?
It's like you went into the woods. Did you get grandmother's permission? You took your basket and you walked
right
there?
Right. It's so simple and cliche to a certain extent. It's almost annoying to say, but we just don't understand each other that well on either side of the mountain.
Crosscut reporter David Croman crossed the mountains, drove I-90 to Ritzville to find out why rural Washington voted for Donald Trump. One of the surprises in Trump's victory was about money. The Clinton campaign out-fundraised Trump 2-1. and it wasn't enough. There's another campaign that failed in Washington despite a financial advantage. KUOW investigative reporter John Ryan brings us the story of Initiative 1464, the Clean Elections Initiative that big money couldn't pass.
There are no limits on spending to try to sell ballot measures to voters. And this year, the side with the most money usually got the go-ahead. Big bucks from billionaires helped convince Washington to adopt a new gun control law. Big bucks from labor unions got us a higher minimum wage and new restrictions on the freedom of public information. Big bucks from the construction industry helped sell the Seattle area on higher taxes for a bigger light rail system. But one of this year's richest initiative campaigns couldn't close a sale with voters.
Four things you should know about Initiative 1464.
This is a campaign ad for that initiative.
1464 limits campaign contributions from lobbyists and government contractors.
The full text of the initiative is 12 pages long.
It closes the revolving door between government and lobbying.
1464 would have made sweeping changes to the role of money in politics. It would have given each Washington resident $150 to distribute to candidates of their choice. But voters almost everywhere turned it down. Only King County and the San Juan Islands said yes. 1464 had little opposition and big bucks behind it, $4 million, mostly from out-of-state donors. Their aim, paradoxically, was to reduce the role of big money in politics. A lot of the same players supported a similar measure on the ballot in the Wild West of secrets and corruption, South Dakota.
Fewer things are illegal here.
David Wiltsey is a political scientist at South Dakota State University.
South Dakota has very, very loose restrictions on lobbyists and has at least a reputation or appearance of some strong corruption.
South Dakota voters approved the Government Accountability and Anti-Corruption Act this month. That's despite opposition from the red state's top elected officials and hefty spending by the billionaire Koch brothers to stop it. Wiltsey says the timing was right.
With the general level of cynicism and anger at what we just vaguely refer to as the establishment, this was the perfect year to kind of stick a finger in the eye of the establishment.
Back in Washington state, voters did pass one measure aimed at draining the apparent swamp of corruption.
People understand that the money in politics is out of control.
Cindy Black is chair of the Yes on 735 campaign. Voters said yes to 735, even though it doesn't have any real-world impact. It only urges our members of Congress to help overturn the Citizens United decision. That case opened the floodgates of political money. Overturning it would take a constitutional amendment, not just an act of Congress.
Ours was really sending a strong message that we don't like how money in elections is affecting us, and we don't like how some of these Supreme Court decisions has affected elections.
Her campaign raised five times less money than the 1464 campaign that failed.
It is kind of curious.
Stuart Elway has been conducting polls for 40 years. This fall, his poll showed 40% of voters undecided about 1464. Elway says the measure has probably the most convoluted wording he's seen in years.
Well, the old saw is that confused voters vote no. Yes, that's true, but unconvinced voters vote no. And if they're confused, they're not going to be convinced.
Elway says it was hard for almost any campaign to get voters' attention this year, except one.
I think the presidential race took a lot of the oxygen out of the room in this state.
But those factors would also apply in South Dakota. It could be that voters in Washington were just less upset about the status quo.
You know, we just didn't have the sense of anger that it was reported on around the country. We're a pretty blue state.
If activists try to get these kinds of reforms on the Washington ballot next year, voters will have more of a track record to judge them by. The city of Seattle launches its voter-approved system of publicly funded campaigns in January. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Fear gripped the nation, and hysteria crept into the American psyche. That's a quote from the University of Puget Sound's website about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. The school saw 36 of its students taken into internment during that time. Tacoma News Tribune columnist Matt Driscoll found out internment is on the mind of many UPS administration members and faculty these days because they have undocumented students at the school today, some through the Federal Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, the DACA program that lets undocumented young people go to American universities without fear of deportation. So last week, more than 1,000 students and faculty delivered a petition to the UPS president demanding their college declare itself a sanctuary university. Driscoll told me what the administration plans to do with that petition.
It remains to be seen. I think what we can say at this point is President Isaiah Crawford, the new president here at UPS, was at least initially very receptive to the idea. He was one of 90 university and college presidents, I believe just last week, that signed on to a letter asking for the continuation and expansion of the Deferred Action Childhood Arrivals Program, DACA. And so, you know, this is obviously an issue that he's already kind of in touch with. And so, you know, what he told me is he was very, very proud to be a part of a university that's dealing with these issues. So just exactly how it moves forward from here kind of remains uncertain, but I would say that so far the administration seems willing to listen and potentially act.
If the University of Puget Sound were a sanctuary campus, what would that mean? What would the school do or not do?
Well, we've got to keep in mind that it's all fairly speculative at this point, and we're kind of grappling with what the Trump administration's stance on immigration is going to actually mean. But what the petition and letter called for was for the school to refuse to release information regarding immigration status, refuse to comply with immigration deportations and raids, prohibit immigration authorities from removing people from campus, and lastly, to ensure financial support for students who might lose federal funding should that go away. So there are four pretty tangible steps that these folks at the school would like the administration to take, and which of those they go for remains to be seen, but that's what people are asking for.
How does that compare to what UPS's policy has been up to now?
I mean, I think like many schools, similar to the University of Washington or other schools, they've already been kind of operating under, you know, like what the University of Washington spokesman pointed me to, a letter from the president there that basically said, we already kind of are in line with what the essence of a sanctuary campus would mean. So, I mean, many of these things are somewhat symbolic, I would say, you know, wanting to take kind of a stance against what Trump's immigration policy might mean. But I think the federal funding component of it is a large risk for these schools to take. There's also just the idea that, you know, across the country there are some 700,000 students studying under the DACA program, and in order to be a part of that, they've given the federal government a lot of information. There's a database with, you know, their information, family members' information. You know, some of those family members are, you know, undocumented as well. And so there was some hesitation from the folks I talked to at UPS even to discuss this with me for fear of putting a spotlight on the school and potentially making the school a target if some of Trump's campaign rhetoric regarding immigration and deportations comes to pass.
You mentioned the University of Washington, a state institution, and they say that they're not ready to become a sanctuary campus?
Well, basically, the stance from the spokesman there that I spoke to was, from their point of view, they're already kind of adhering to, you know, the essence of what it means to be a sanctuary campus by not complying with DACA and not, you know, participating in raids and not releasing information. And so, from their standpoint, declaring themselves a sanctuary campus wouldn't have a lot of meaning. The actions speak louder than the words, and I guess would be a way to paraphrase what I heard from them.
You talked to a UPS student, Amanda Diaz. What did she tell you?
Well, she's one of, you know, many students studying there at UPS now. She is not undocumented, but she is kind of the student representative or one of the student representatives working on this. And, you know, she told me that she's spoken to at least a few undocumented students or students studying under the DACA program who are already considering leaving next semester or not returning. It's putting a lot of fear in people. I ask if it was safe to say that students were freaked out about what this means, and she told me that freaked out would be an understatement. So I think there's a lot of fear.
You spoke to a documented student. Amanda, are undocumented students not willing to talk to you?
Yeah, basically that's the ticker. I mean, there was a lot of hesitation from even the folks I did speak to talk to me about this, just because, you know, the fear of kind of, again, putting UPS in a spotlight and drawing attention to the potential of undocumented students there. And, you know, obviously as a journalist, you know, when she told me that there were students who were considering leaving, you know, my first question was, well, can I talk to some of them? And basically what I was told was, we're trying our best to protect their privacy and and their safety in this process. And so there's still a hesitancy to even draw a bigger spotlight or target on these students by going on record and talking about it.
It sounds like there are worries about, as you said, putting a spotlight on UPS and their students. And yet you're also having students and faculty asking UPS to take a big stand here and declare itself a sanctuary university. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note that this isn't a small handful of students here at UPS. I mean, they drafted this letter and came up with a petition, and within less than 3 days, it had over 1,000 signatures. Many of the folks I spoke to harkened back to a history of Japanese-American internment during World War II, and there were actually 36 students who were sent to relocation camps from UPS. That's a history there that they're very aware of, and, you know, a lot of people have a lot of regret and shame over, and so I think, you know, seeing the way this is playing out and just the rhetoric surrounding immigration, it's important for a lot of people to kind of be proactive and take a public stand on that.
Is being a sanctuary campus purely symbolic, or is this a policy departure that is going to concretely keep students away from federal immigration authorities?
Yeah, and you're asking great questions, and unfortunately, I don't think there are concrete answers to some of this. I mean, I think from my point of view, part of it is symbolic, right? I mean, part of it is taking a stance. You know, in UPS's situation, the request that the school work to replace the potentially lost federal funding for students, now that's pretty concrete, right? And if they are able to do that, that will be more than symbolic. You know, as one of the professors there told me, that's putting their money where their mouth is, right? But I think there are a lot of questions at this point about whether, you know, private universities, colleges even have the, you know, legal standing to protect students from, you know, deportation efforts. And this is the new world we live in, and everybody's kind of grappling with it, and we'll see what happens.
Tacoma News Tribune columnist Matt Driscoll. Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
And we will tweet out a link to Matt Driscoll's Tacoma News Tribune column right now at KUOW. Luann Thompson described the week after the November 8th election as a whirlwind. And in that whirlwind, she realized something. Luann is a professor of oceanography at the University of Washington. Her realization? Climate change scientists can't just talk about their findings with other like-minded scientists at universities and research labs. With a Trump presidency imminent, climate change scientists must figure out how to explain their science to people who either aren't interested or flat out deny that climate change is a problem.
Well, there's been a lot of talk within the Trump transition team about funding of climate research and also backing out of the Paris Accord. That changes both how we study the climate system as well as the role of the United States in mitigating against future climate change.
Should scientists be reacting to elections?
Oh, I think we have to. I think that we live within the sort of body politic of the United States. I mean, most of my funding comes from the federal government. So in terms of reacting to, I have to make plans about my research group and where that's going, and that's going to be impacted by the Trump administration.
But do you aim your research at protecting your funding?
No, I don't. But I do have concerns about keeping my research going. So I absolutely work on problems that I think are important and tractable with the resources that are available.
I interview scientists sometimes, we do here at KUOW, and it can be hard to translate their knowledge to listeners. You're kind of rolling your eyes and kind of nodding your head. Why is that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's partly because when we get into our own science, we get really excited about it and about the details. And, you know, there's one thing to talk about the details of my research, which probably wouldn't be very interesting to your listeners. But
why not?
Broader, well, I mean, I'll get stuck in all the technical jargon and talking about why I think that this particular part of the ocean is important for interacting with the atmosphere. But when I think about the broader issues of climate science, I think Those are things that we have to get better at communicating about, not just about our small piece of the puzzle. So it's, say, talking about the results of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the community of scientists that work together to figure out what's going on in our planet and what we expect will happen in the future.
So take me from the way things are now to what you're hoping for. Typically, you'd have a finding and you would publish it in a scientific journal?
Right. So typically what I do is I have a research result or a graduate student has a research result and we present it at a national or international meeting. I just presented research in France on some satellite sea level research I was doing. Or you go to the American Geophysical Union and then you write a paper that you submit to a journal. It gets reviewed by your peers and it's published. And that's sort of the end.
And what's the limit of that?
The limit of that is the audience, right? You are only reaching the people who are interested in that particular area of research and can access the information through the technical information within the publication. It's not usually that accessible. Plus, a lot of the journals have paywalls, so not anyone can look at the results of the publications.
And what do you want to do differently?
So I think that what we need to do differently is to think about our science as part of this overall enterprise and understanding the planet and communicating the broader issues about climate science. Many of us do that, but I think we have to get better at it and we have to get better at reaching different audiences.
So give us an example. I'm picturing Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson is awesome, right? But not everyone is Neil deGrasse Tyson, but you can think about audiences in a number of different ways. You can think about our students that we reach, you know, from freshmen through graduate students. You can think about our peers, as I've described. You can think about sort of people who are on the environmental activist side that sort of believe that there are big things going on in our planet, and you can help them to gain a better understanding. And then you can think about people that maybe either haven't thought about it or are actively skeptical about issues related to climate science and climate change. Sure.
What is it like for you and other scientists on that other microphone trying to translate what you do in an interview?
It's really tough. And in fact, I went through a communications training and I was stymied at one point because one of the interviews viewers was struggling to sort of get what I was working on. And so he said, okay, Luann, since you're an oceanographer, what do you feel when you're on the bow of the ship looking out over the waves? And I froze because all of my work is with climate models and satellite data, and I don't go to sea. So how do I explain being an oceanographer, being interested in the role of the oceans and climate, but I don't scuba dive, I don't study whales, and I just got stuck.
Well, what can you do about that? You don't scuba dive.
No, and actually I have a pat answer now that I give, and all of my oceans are on my computer, and I like to keep them that way, but I also have to explain how much we can learn about the planet by using Earth-observing satellites, by using climate models, by combining the information to those two data streams, and we can get at questions that you can't get at by just looking at the ocean from, you know, a ship.
Is there a popular misconception about you and about climate scientists? We've heard so much about people, about mistrust of the elites, right? And so if Trump voters just they're in their bubble, other people are in other bubbles, and they don't trust a liberal elitist scientist, what can you do about that?
Well, I've been thinking about that, and that's something that I talked about in the blog post I wrote recently about. It's not only climate science we have to talk about, we also have to talk about how science is done and this sort of skeptical framework with which we come to science, that we're not doing it to get paid our salary. We're doing it to find truth in the world. And we also have to acknowledge that we're very privileged to do this work because it's an awful lot of fun. And, you know, it's like solving a puzzle every day when you come into work. But we're not happy until that puzzle is solved. And somehow communicating that scientific enterprise, I kind of feel like we have to do that better.
So are you calling on your fellow scientists to make a difficult switch in mindset?
I'm not sure if I'm calling on scientists to do that. I think most of us are pretty agree with how things are going to be done. Maybe I'm calling on us to be a little bit braver about getting out into the world.
braver.
Yeah. It's scary to put yourself in front of an audience of 50 people at a library. I know it doesn't seem like it when we all go into a classroom every day, but it's a different audience. You don't know what they're going to throw at you. You often have to, do additional research to cover areas that you might not be expert on. And, you know, since you're a skeptical scientist, you want to have confidence in what you say. So it is kind of a scary thing to do.
What's at stake if you fail?
Well, the future of the planet. I think that's sort of the the pat answer. And I think not only the future of the planet, but the power that science has to make the world a better place, whether it's with climate change or anything else.
Luann Thompson is a professor of oceanography at the University of Washington. She directs the program on climate change, and she knows how to tell you about it, too. She doesn't scuba dive. She does not get pulled around the ocean by dolphins. We're tweeting out a link to Professor Thompson's blog post now, so join us on Twitter at KUOW. So that's the view from one Seattle climate researcher. Then there are the professional environmental activists who see themselves and their hard-won environmental regulations as targets in a Trump administration. You'll find out how they plan to keep the new president from rolling back eco rules coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Now on KUOW's The Record, we turn to educating our children. South of Seattle, the Highline School District has been focusing on early learning, getting kids ready to hit the ground running in kindergarten. The district is working with low-income families even before they get to preschool, as early as birth. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld says it all starts with Baby Academy for parents.
On a sunny Saturday morning, about a dozen moms and dads are looking at a picture of a little boy pouring syrup on his pancakes.
What do you think would happen if I said nothing at all? How much would he put on there?
He might put way too much.
So even though it's really, really basic, there's some math and measurement and prediction stuff that's happening here. And you can verbalize that.
These parents have signed up for 9 weeks of weekend classes in child development called the Glee Baby Academy. Meanwhile, their young kids play in classrooms across the courtyard. The program is meant to show parents that education does not begin at school, that they are their children's first teachers. In Highline School District, two-thirds of all students come from low-income families. More than a quarter of students are still learning English. Those factors can get in the way of school readiness.
Our youngest students needed additional supports if they were going to arrive at kindergarten with the skills they needed to be successful.
Ann Arnold is the district's director of early learning. She says too many kids arrive at kindergarten lacking skills they need, like counting, knowing the alphabet, and social-emotional skills.
There's definitely a sense that schools will take care of things when they arrive, and that once children are there, they will begin their education process. And what we want to share with parents is the fact that the first 5 years of that child's life present a tremendous opportunity to impact the long-term success of that child.
So the district used a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to partner with the King County Housing Authority. The district identified families living in public housing in White Center who have babies or babies on the way. Highline invited those families to take part in the two-month baby academy, followed by support for the first 3 years of their children's lives. It's a model based on the Harlem Children's Zone in New York City, aimed at providing cradle-to-career help and guidance for kids and their families. Part of that support is home visits to check in with families and to monitor kids' development.
Moise, how you doing, buddy?
How old are you now? Four years old?
That's amazing. Last time I saw you, you were 3 years old.
On this morning, Glee family advocate Camille Churchill is in Angel Madrid's living room with her one-year-old daughter Yafa and four-year-old son Moise. Madrid is from Honduras. Her husband is American. Churchill asks Madrid what language she speaks to Moise and what he speaks to his mother.
All English, some both.
He makes Spanish, yeah.
So but mostly English.
English, yeah.
With a little Spanish.
Yeah.
Churchill praises Madrid for raising Moise bilingual.
Sometimes I force him to speak in Spanish, and I say, I'm sorry, I don't understand, what do you want? He tried. He asked me, how do you say in Spanish this word? And I say, listen. He said, you need to speak in Spanish.
Only special people know Spanish, so you need to keep your Spanish.
Churchill asked Moise to show her the numbers he knows and to run and hop and skip around the room.
I want to ask you some really, really big words and see if you can say it. Can you say sedimentary?
Sedimentary.
Nice. Can you say ostracize?
Ostracize.
You guys have done an excellent job with his language. He is just giving me 10-word sentences. He has really good thought processes.
The goal of these visits is to catch developmental delays early on. For minor issues, parents learn skill-building activities they can do with their kids. Children with more serious delays get referrals to agencies that can help get them up to speed.
I think it's a really cool program.
Madrid says she and her husband have learned a lot in the past year and a half they've been a part of GLEE.
How to teach them in the young age what kind of games to play and how important it is to read when they are young, too.
At Highline School District, Ann Arnold says GLEE has been so popular that parents from other districts have asked to take part, too.
We have had huge response to the program. We've had very significant participation amongst our community in the White Center area.
The program is now expanding to another school in the neighborhood. Arnold says the real test will be to see how the kids who entered the program as babies do once they reach kindergarten. In White Center, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
Earlier this fall, Anne reported on how bias is not just a police problem, it's a preschool problem. And you can find that story by searching preschool at our website, KUOW.org. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Chances are, no matter where you were for Thanksgiving this year, West Coast, East Coast, in between, at least some of the apples in your apple pie were grown here in Washington State. How did we become the kings of apple growing in Washington? Well, food anthropologist Julia Harrison says partly because of an improbable cross-continental romance, where a young British man travels to Fort Vancouver along the Columbia River.
Around 1826 or 1827, there was this young man who was sent over from London on a tour of inspection. And the idea was that, you know, he would come to the fort and report back about what was going on there. And at his going away party in London, this is where the story gets kind of romantic and you can kind of, you know, play your violins in the background. There was a young woman and she was flirting with this guy. And over they were having apples for dessert, which is a fairly common thing in that time, that you would have the sweetest, best apples, and you would sort of slice them up with your lovely silver service and eat them as dessert. So she removed the seeds from her dessert apple and wrapped them up in paper and gave them to this young man as a souvenir, as something to remember her by when he got to the New World. So he got to the fort, and you can imagine the difference between, you know, London high society and this log fort in the middle of the territory. And he discovered this packet of seeds, and he gave them to the people at the fort, and they actually grew them. So those trees eventually were sturdy enough to be transplanted outside, and they were put into the ground outside the gates of Fort Vancouver. And from what I've read, I think like something like 4 to 6 of the trees survived. And there is still one of them that's living. And it is known very imaginatively as the old apple tree. Right.
You got that from an airport novel.
Oh, I really should have. Like, it's so great. I think, you know, it would make such a wonderful, like, Hallmark, you know, after school special kind of thing. So that tree now is still there. You can still visit it. It's not looking particularly good. It's survived all sorts of threats. I-5 is actually right behind it. And the original drawings for I-5 would have called for the removal of this tree.
Of the old apple tree?
But people, there was this outcry. The tree was saved. And I-5 was actually bent to go around it.
Why do apples grow so well in Washington State?
There's a variety of reasons. So definitely in different parts of the state, either different kind of apples grow well or there is different capacity for production. To the east of the Cascades, what people found was really some of the best potential commercial apple growing land anywhere in the country. And so a huge part of that is the soil. So we come from this volcanic region, that sort of backbone of volcanoes up and down the state. And that interspersed a lot of ash in the soil. So the soil is very rich in these particular types of mineral nutrition that apples really thrive on. It tends to drain really well, which is also helpful. And then depending on the part of the state, on the contours of the land and the altitude, you also get this wonderful temperature range between very, very hot, clear days in the summer and then much colder nights. So that's what you need for the apples to not only grow, but to develop the complex sugars inside them and to change the color of the apple, because I'm sure you've watched apples develop and seen how the color of the skin changes. So if you didn't have that contrast, you wouldn't have that full development that you really need to have a good eating out of hand apple.
It sounds like we have the perfect natural climate for apples.
Yeah.
But we also, something happened with our business climate because this turned into a mega industry.
True.
What happened?
Well, there's been a couple of waves of big events. The first one was probably the involvement of the railroad. So the first rail line went into North Yakima in about 1885. And from that point on, the railroad had to concentrate on trying to get a return on that enormous investment. So one of the things that the railroads would do that I kind of love to imagine, again, this is another good Hallmark special, they would send agents into places, ports of entry like Seattle or Tacoma, places where, you know, there were young men flooding in from all over the world who were trying to look for better economic opportunities. And these agents would go up to a likely looking young man and say, like, you know, you look like you know a good thing when you hear it. And they would essentially offer them a free trip out to Yakima on this new railroad line on the condition that they would just look at some of this orchard land. So this is just textbook exactly like, you know, a timeshare lure, right? Come to Florida and check out this property, no strings attached. So, and this actually worked.
We just want you to listen to a talk.
Just a sales pitch.
Sales pitch.
Yeah, have a cup of coffee. Hmm. So one guy that this worked on was a Swedish migrant named Alfred Johnson. And Alfred Johnson migrated to this area in around 1901. And he went out to Yakima and liked what he saw. And so he purchased this orchard land from the railroads. And his family business is still there. And it's this wonderful kind of time travel-y oasis of trees. And, you know, it's still in the same place, but the city of Yakima has kind of swollen around it, or like a lava flow. And they're now in, I believe, at least their fourth generation of family ownership. Somebody told me that recently they were actually transitioning to their fifth generation. And they are still able to pick some fruit off of trees that were planted by Alfred Johnson himself.
A lot of time has passed since the early railroad days.
Yeah.
And there are other places that could grow apples. Why has Washington State been almost dominant in American apples since, you know, for a long time since those early railroad days?
Well, I think we successfully staked our claim on consumers' imaginations and tastes pretty early on. So another sort of strange icon of the early days was the apple crate and the apple crate label. And that developed around the 1890s in the Columbia River. So, you know, before that, when you were just maybe selling apples to your neighbors or somebody across town, you could just put them in, you know, a gunny sack or a basket or whatever you happen to have around. But when you start talking about transporting fruit in large volumes and long distances, you want to have something that's very sturdy and regular to hold them in. And so they began to use these pine crates. And then once you get these pine crates all the way to the East Coast, who wants to open every single one of them to see what's inside? So you slap a label on the outside of it. And the labels started to get more and more elaborate and also more kind of poetic. So, you know, some of them are a little cartoonish, but a lot of them have these really powerful and evocative images of the cultures of the Pacific Northwest, the natural beauty, the sort of athleticism and exoticism of this part of the world that a lot of people weren't able to experience directly, but they could get this taste of it through both the apples and these apple labels. And I think that that really did help to capture market share, but also kind of, stamp people's kind of imaginations with our area.
I know we sell a lot of apples here. Mm-hmm. I see them in the grocery store. I think, oh, I wonder why are we Apple Land? That's about as far as I've taken it. You have gone deep into Washington State apples. And what has that changed you somehow, that knowledge you have?
Yeah, I think it has certainly changed my approach to buying food and gleaning food.
Gleaning.
Talking to people about food. You know, a starting point for me for this research was looking out at this apple tree that was growing in the front yard of the apartment building where I live. And just thinking, like, I've lived here for, you know, at that point, probably 5 or 6 years. I've never tried an apple off of that tree. Like, why have I never done that? Why do I go to the store and buy all of these apples? And, you know, of course, the question is much more complicated than me just being, you know, brainwashed by the military food production complex. The apples that are growing in that tree are not particularly edible because they are, I think, originally a variety that was grown for cider production. So not something that you want to just go and pick and eat. So what I think that the apple has done for me has really given me a different sense of what is nature and what our interventions into the natural world have been, and to kind of think about the consequences of those, both good and bad. And it's also given me this sense that the world that I live in is essentially a document that we are all editing together. And every time I see a fruit tree or an apple tree, it is one of those little like green marks that comes up in Google Docs that shows you that someone else has edited what you're seeing. So, you know, in my weird neighborhood of all these, you know, kind of jumbled together apartment buildings, that apple tree is a reminder of a way of life that is not there anymore. And it's a reminder of somebody else's goals and hopes for the landscape around them.
Now you know a food anthropologist. That's Julia Harrison, who's been looking into the history of apples in Washington State. And she's been traveling across the state, sharing her stories of apples as part of Humanities Washington's Speakers Bureau program. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. When Seattle's most famous reader, Nancy Pearl, recommends a book to you, she takes into account a bunch of things. But Nancy tells our arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman it always comes down to great writing. And today she brings you one of her favorite writers.
I always love it when the author's name is bigger than the title of the book. Ian McEwan is the author, and the book's called Nutshell. His name comes first.
Yes, because Ian McEwan is the author of a great many terrific novels. The one that most people are probably familiar with is Atonement. And this is his newest book. Last month, it was announced that Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I'm still not sure how I feel about that, but I'll tell you who I think should win the Nobel Prize for Literature, and that's Ian McEwan. Ian McEwan does not ever write the same book twice. And each of his books, I mean, they share themes, but each of his books is unique. And this one, Nutshell, is especially wonderfully different from anything that you've read. It's narrated by a fetus, and that fetus's mother is named Gertrude, and she and his uncle are scheming to kill his father. Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
So what he's done in this book is take the plot of Hamlet and jigger it around to come up with this amazingly original take on Shakespeare's play, and also give us this character who is so real to us. And then the ending is just fabulous.
I'm so fascinated because listeners, you can't see the book. I can see the book. And normally when we talk about people who should win Nobel Prizes, they're big, fat tomes. And I have to say that this is a normal-sized book.
It is. Ian McEwan does not write huge books. In fact, one of his most one of his award-winning books on Chesil Beach is very, very, very small. But that's because for Ian McEwan, every word counts, and he's not going to waste words in building up a word count.
So let me just say, a few weeks ago we talked about editors and how important editors were. I would argue that somebody who doesn't waste my time with too many words does deserve an award with his editor.
Yeah, but, you know, that's his style. It seems to me, and I've read and enjoyed all of his books in varying degrees, he's not going to ever be a verbose writer. He's going to cut to the chase and give you lots to think about and just to appreciate in his books. He has a great, I mean, I've never met him, but it seems to me from several of his novels, he has a great sense of humor.
Well, one of Nancy Pearl's candidates for Nobel Prize in Literature is Ian McEwan, McEwan, and his new book is called Nutshell. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Nancy Pearl and Marcy Silman, talking books every week. You'll find Nancy's recommendations at KUOW.org.